Chapter 4. After the fascination came the fear. I had no idea how long I was supposed to work with Barry that first night. I considered it a kind of orientation session. We weren't going to get into any of the specifics of determining how the technology worked. That seemed obvious to me, especially since I was still reeling from the effects of what I'd witnessed. We'd had that science-gasm, as Barry had put it, and in the lull afterward, we sat at the workbench, each of us lost in thought. It was an awkward situation, to say the least. Barry and I knew nothing about one another, our educations, our previous work experience. We'd been thrown into a room together, and he'd proceeded to demonstrate to me how the technology worked. After that, it seemed as if there wasn't much else to talk about in terms of the devices. We had the what, or so we both believed, but now we had to turn our attention to the how. Finally, I said to Barry, "So, how long have you been working at this?" His expression darkened, and he let out a noisy breath through his nose. "I don't know if I can tell you that." He screwed up his face in disgust at what he'd just said. "What I mean, of course, I'm capable of telling you that. I know the answer to the question. I'm not stupid or brainwashed. I just don't know if I'm allowed to tell you that." We both looked around the room. We were alone, but given what we both knew, the enormity of what those devices represented, the kind of security clearance required, it made sense that we were being surveilled. In fact, that was a part of the transition I was experiencing in going from being fascinated to being fearful. That's not completely accurate. I wasn't in a kind of binary situation where I was either fascinated or afraid. I was both simultaneously, but just in different proportions. That would prove to be the case the entire time I worked there. Part of that fear was a result of realizing my ambition. I always wanted to work with large and powerful forces. That was what I loved about jet cars and explosives and incendiary displays like fireworks. I knew enough about them that I felt I could control them. What I'd seen on the workbench with the emitter and reactor wasn't something that I felt I could control. I understood that it was turned on by placing the two objects in proximity to one another. That kind of powering up wasn't that unusual, by the way. A Tesla coil and some radio transmitters have a similar functionality. Beyond that, I had no understanding of how it produced a gravitational field and controlled that field. That lack of understanding was absolutely frightening. What went unsaid, and what I didn't really think of until after that first orientation session was over and I was on my way back to Las Vegas, were the larger implications of what this propulsion system represented. What if we were able to figure out how it operated? What if we were able to produce a similar kind of effect, or the same effect? If we could help our government and military produce a gravitational field, what kind of weapons systems would be possible? What kind of propulsion systems? What kind of energy production? How would we be able to change the world as we knew it? And as cliched as it sounds, what if that technology fell into the wrong hands? To what lengths would nations or individuals go to get what seemed to me to be, as the expression goes, the keys to the kingdom? If you could produce and control gravity, if you could distort space and time as we commonly know them and accept them, what then? I had to stop myself. I knew that those questions weren't going to get me any closer to doing what I had been hired to do. I'd learned while working at Los Alamos that the kind of institutional compartmentalization that went on there, and was also in place here, was the kind that I needed to put in place in my own mind. It's above my pay grade. I'd do my job as asked and leave the bigger questions for others. That was going to be more difficult here, but I knew that I had to make my best effort, or else who knew what might happen to me. Fascination and fear were going to have to learn to get along. Of course, though, I couldn't shut down every thought I had. I did wonder briefly why it was that what seemed to me to be a relatively small group of people were working on a project that had the kinds of implications that this one did. Los Alamos and the project to produce nuclear bombs involved an enormous number of people and resources. Still, very few people outside of the program actually knew what was being conducted out in the deserts of New Mexico. For all I knew, there were teams all over the country working on this same project as Barry and I. At least, I wanted to believe that. I wasn't so egotistical as to believe that I was one of only a select few working on something so monumentally important as this was.
"I feel like I should tell you this, though," Barry said haltingly. "I have no idea how long this project has been in progress. I do know that I was brought on, and I assume you were, out of necessity. Maybe this is very obvious, but we need to be careful."
He nodded toward the bench where the two pieces sat there, looking as benign as some kind of Scandinavian sculptures that some Hollywood hipster might have had in his home. He went on to explain that he'd been informed about an accident that had occurred that necessitated him being hired. He wasn't given any of the real details, but, as he put it, those involved were unable to work again. By his tone and his expression, I knew that he meant that there had been a loss of life. I stood there trying to imagine what it was those individuals might have done. As Barry said, he wanted me to know, because we were all under pressure to figure out the solution to this puzzle. There was also the temptation to take shortcuts, to take risks, and the consequences of a bad choice, being too eager to please or too frustrated to consider every possible effect when dealing with such an unknown, could have enormous consequences. That was a part of the fear. On the surface, without all those science fiction-like displays of the propulsion system's power and capabilities, it appeared completely benign, a marvel of simplicity and elegant engineering of a type that was astoundingly sublime. Beneath that benign veneer was something more powerful than anything I had previously imagined. Yes, it was fascinating to consider. It had an allure that drew me in. But just as magnets have poles that attract and repel, I sensed in those first few hours in the lab that I was also going to feel respect for the intelligence behind its creation and a kind of nervous anxiety that I'd never experienced before in my personal or professional life. A whole lot was at stake here, and to be incautious in any way seemed to be the least desirable approach to take. A last resort that I hoped I would never even have to contemplate. At some point, well into the early hours of the morning, Dennis came in to let me know that I was done for the night. He escorted me out of the room and sat with me briefly in a small office off the main corridor waiting area. "This will be your routine for the foreseeable future," he told me. "Once you have your final clearance, you'll be housed on site." "Barry?" I asked. A flash of annoyance flickered across Dennis's face, but he answered, "Still working." A faint ringing sounded in my ears. It was as if I'd been concentrating so hard for so long that the tension in every nerve and tendon in my body was as taut as a piano wire and was still vibrating long after the key had been depressed. "You'll be partners," Dennis said. "You'll discuss your work with him, solely here, and with no one else." "Understood." I was about to say that I understood that the first time that he'd mentioned that protocol to me, but thought better of it. Above my pay grade to remind Dennis Mariani of anything. We spent a few minutes going over my proposed schedule. Dennis wanted to be sure that I didn't have any conflicts with times and dates. Despite the tango of fear and fascination that I had, I assured him that I would clear my calendar to be certain that I'd be able to report as needed. He reminded me again that the security clearance could take some time. "If you can think of anything that might get in the way of you being approved or even slowing the process, let me know now. It will be far easier and can speed things up."
I can't think of a thing, I told him, and I spoke the truth as I did. On the flight home, I thought again of the immense power the reactor and emitter produced and directed. I couldn't imagine what those individuals involved in the accident might have done to wind up dead. I imagined that they had to understand that what they were working with had the power equivalent to what our sun possesses. That is a mind-bogglingly large amount of energy. I'd touched the emitter and the reactor. They were made of a material that could only have been cut into with something like a plasma torch. Who in their right mind, or with enough testosterone in them, would even consider applying that tool to something so powerful? Imagine someone taking the power of the sun and shrinking that reactor to the size of a small box and putting it into a room with you and saying, "Isn't that amazing?" "Sure is. Let's cut it up to see what's inside." "Okay, sounds great." As a result, I knew that it was unlikely these guys had done something really stupid. If they had, I'd feel bad for them, but essentially, they got what they deserved. Instead, they may have done something far less stupid, possibly something extremely intelligent or insightful, and still they'd lost their lives. That scenario was far more frightening to me. I was going to engage in work with something unknown, and I might even, while being the most scrupulous and cautious as I could be, still end up doing great harm to myself and possibly others. Even when I got home and lay in bed next to Tracy, I contemplated that thought, and as the sun rose the next morning, I began to wonder just how many more of those beginnings of a new day I might end up seeing. From seemingly out of nowhere, a thought occurred to me. What if the guys we had to replace had completely misunderstood the nature of the objects? What if they couldn't get their minds wrapped around the idea that something so small could be producing that kind of energy? Maybe they thought that it was retransmitting energy being produced elsewhere. That had to be it. It made sense, then, that since there were no outward signs, heat, noise, etc., that it was producing power, it made sense to them to dig beneath that surface to see how it functioned. The same with the emitter. It was essentially empty space, a kind of shell without any obvious other components, as we understood them, attached to its surface. The housing seemed inert, because it was only when the fuel, the triangular bit that Barry introduced to the tower, was in place that the system functioned. Maybe those guys weren't doing something stupid, but only in hindsight could we see the error of their way. Before I could go on any further, I felt Tracy stirring beside me.
"Good morning," I said.
When she didn't respond, I repeated my greeting, slightly louder. Still getting nothing in return, I slid out of bed and went to my desk. I had more pickups and deliveries to make, and despite only what seemed to be a few minutes of sleep, I knew that I had to get the day going. If I got the call, I was going to have to be ready. By noon, bleary-eyed and better able to identify the cause of the ringing in my ears as sleeplessness, I decided that even after just a couple of trips out to Groom Lake, this schedule was unsustainable. I thought it was going to be just a question of a short period of time before I was on staff full-time at the lab. I'd been living there, and I wouldn't be able to keep the photo business operation on my own. Tracy was familiar with the routine and could handle the workload on days I was called in or the mornings after. I'd have to show her how to use the machines. I knew she had the aptitude for it, since she'd shown some interest in the rocket car and other things mechanical. Besides, she was taking flying lessons, and the pre-flight checks and other routines associated with that were more complex than a photo processor. The one difficulty was that she was working at a local airport doing administrative duties for the airport manager. She liked the work and had a great relationship with everyone there. I hoped that we could leverage that last fact to our advantage. I wasn't asking her to take on the whole photo business. She'd just have to fill in on an as-needed basis. The problem with that is that we never got enough advance warning for her to ask ahead of time if she could be out for a few hours or a whole day. Maybe I was naive, but it seemed to me that her job wasn't so essential that some accommodation couldn't be made. And with that hope in mind, I returned home and we began the transition to a different way of life. Since I'd worked at Los Alamos before, and because Tracy's father had, I assumed that the secretive nature of the enterprise I was engaged in wasn't going to present any problems. Tracy knew that I couldn't talk about the exact nature of the work I was doing, and so I didn't really broach that part of the subject with her. I did address the fact that my schedule would be, for a while at least, irregular at best. I told her that I didn't like it, but if I wanted to do the kind of meaningful work that made me happy and provided a better living for us, then that was the price to pay. She agreed. As she put it, "I'm not jumping for joy about it, but I get it. You have to do what you have to do." So with that assurance in mind, I brought her up to speed as best I could on what her new role would be. Her employers proved to be flexible, and so on those occasions when I wasn't able to be working in the photo processing lab or needed a few hours of extra sleep, Tracy would cover for me. As it turned out, things didn't prove to run as smoothly as I'd hoped, and I was still being run ragged most days, adding to what would eventually be a heap of stress. It was far easier for me to do that than it had been for Barry to do so for me, and I have to admit that I was frequently distracted while at home. I love problems and puzzles, and the one that I encountered while working for EG&G was so engrossing that my mind would frequently take me back to the lab. I loved Tracy and the life we had together, but I did find myself hoping that every time the phone rang, it would be the voice of the receptionist. At least, that was the job that belonged to the pleasant but disembodied voice on the line, letting me know it was time to head to McCarran. I could never predict when the call would come, but when it did, I bid Tracy a quick goodbye and a gotta go. A few times, dinner plans with friends had to be postponed, but Tracy and I were pretty much homebodies, so the disruption felt, to me at least, to be minimal. My relationship with Barry was about as no-nonsense as a work relationship could be. I understood that I couldn't act out like I had in my Los Alamos days, but Barry kept himself on an incredibly tight leash. That first night we worked together was really the extent of him sharing any information that wasn't directly related to the work we were planning on doing that night or in the hours ahead. I suppose that part of that might have been that I was still considered, though no one referred to me this way, as a temp. The larger factor in Barry's tight-lipped approach was the presence of armed security personnel. Whether some member of the security detail was in the room with us the entire time, or dropped in unannounced and exited unannounced, they shadowed our existence within the confines of the lab, the building the lab was housed in, and the entire facility. Whether the security team members had pistols or rifles varied at times, but it was clear that they meant business. Whether they were there to protect us or to keep us in line was never something I could decide firmly, but came to believe that it was likely both. Whenever we left the lab, to go to the restroom or the cafeteria, we were always escorted, not just to those rooms, but inside them. The second night I worked there, I received a reminder of just how tightly monitored I was going to be. As was true the first time, and, as it turned out, every time I was on the ground at Groom Lake, Dennis picked me up at the airfield. Unlike the first time, though, when we entered through a side door into the administration and laboratory section of the facility, we pulled around to the front of the building. This time, the door to one of the hangars was open. Dennis indicated that I should go inside through the large open door and into the bay. Inside sat a cylindrical craft, typical of the flying saucers that I'd seen depicted in blurry photos and in TV shows and the movies. As I got nearer, I saw an American flag emblazoned on one of its flanks. The flag was printed in reverse, so that if you were looking in a mirror, the image would be correct. I thought that I understood better at this point. This was an experimental terrestrial aircraft. The story I'd been told in those reports was a kind of cover designed to keep me somewhat in the dark about the operational nature of the facility, etc. As we walked past the craft, I did what I think anyone would do when walking past this type of vehicle. I ran my hand along the surface. Immediately, one of the guards walking along with us snapped at me, "Hands off!" His menacing voice was so loud, I was startled. The sound of it echoed in the space, and I wondered if it was my imagination, or did I really hear the sound of weapon being cocked? In either case, the message was clear. They had a very stringent set of protocols, and I was being kept on a very tight leash. Not for the first time would I have to rein in some of my impulses if I wanted to get along with an employer. With the institutional gray walls, the fluorescent lights, the armed guard, and no hint of collegiality, much less joviality, even after the first week or so of working there, I very much began to feel like I was imprisoned in the confines of the facility that I would eventually hear being referred to as S4. I don't recall exactly the circumstances surrounding the discovery of that name. We didn't exist in complete monastic silence, though most conversations in the cafeteria were somewhat hushed, and we were forced to eat at a table solely with our work partners. The tables we sat at were spread at a distance, so that all I could generally hear were murmurs. Regardless, S4 was where I was now spending a few days a week at irregular intervals and for irregular spans of hours. Though Barry and I had somewhat different temperaments, for example, I seldom wore protective clothing while working with dangerous chemicals and was more willing to take chances with my personal safety than he was, and approaches to problem-solving, I tended to trust my gut while Barry was more methodical and programmatic, that is, by the book, we agreed on one point. The powers that be wanted to understand how this craft's propulsion system worked, so that meant we needed to concentrate our efforts on working with the reactor. As I saw in the first demonstrations Barry made, the reactor was comprised of three parts, the housing, the tower, and the fuel. All three of those parts were relatively simple in design, seemingly manufactured from the same material based on appearance, yet they worked in concert to produce that astounding amount of power with 100% efficiency. To put that into context, the most highly refined electric motors we have on Earth operate at about 85% efficiency. Some energy is lost through the production of heat. An internal combustion engine operates at about 35% efficiency. We lose some power again through the production of heat and gaseous exhaust. Electric motors have fewer moving parts than your car's motor does, so it made sense in one way that the fewer the parts, the better. In the case of the alien technology, the parts within the reactor didn't seem to move at all, thus making for a highly efficient means of producing power with no waste. Imagine having a fireplace that burned hot enough to heat your entire home, but the chimney or stovepipe remained completely cool to the touch. That's efficient. All the energy being produced is used to serve our purposes. If you've ever driven your car past electric power lines and had the radio reception interfered with, you've experienced the inefficiency of our systems. Some of the electricity being carried in those lines has leaked out and mixed itself up with the radio waves, resulting in the production of static. We wondered whether or not there was any leakage in the propulsion system, so we measured all around the room to detect for stray energy waves and discovered none. Less scientifically, we had a radio playing in the lab, and its reception was as clear with the reactor and amplifier on as with it off. Even back then, I realized that I was focusing, probably too much, on the concept of the system's efficiency. That it had allowed the craft to travel millions of light years meant that it had to be efficient, that its propulsion and other systems, life support, guidance, or whatever, had to remain operational over a long period and vast distances. As far as I could tell, based on the brief glimpse I had of the craft itself, it had no external fuel tanks or other obvious means of carrying enormous quantities of some substance to power the craft. That led me to think that maybe the entire craft itself was producing energy. Maybe what we thought of as the reactor was just a small part of a larger system that produced the energy needed for flight and guidance. Or maybe what we considered the housing, the outer shell that contained the tower and the fuel disk, was more than just housing and was integrally involved in the production of the gravity wave we witnessed. One of the first things we did was to consider how the device itself, its very structure, might contribute to the production of this enormous amount of energy. We decided to see if we could determine what kind of reaction was being produced inside the device that held the fuel cell, even when that copper-colored triangle wasn't present. Did the housing itself produce some kind of measurable effect? Electromagnetic, chemical, radioactive? Did the reactor's material composition contribute to the production of the gravitational field? Did it absorb some of the waste heat? And if so, did it then convert that energy captured into a different kind of energy that produced the field? To determine this, we used a measurement device, a kind of miniature Geiger counter, to detect the presence of radioactive emissions, beta particles or gamma rays. Instead of utilizing a Geiger tube, this much smaller device used a small chip transistor that was sensitive to radiation. We placed that on the tower in place of the small fuel disk. Almost instantaneously, the readout indicated that the space inside the reactor, even without the fuel being present, was being bombarded by particles, producing a relatively intense field of radiation within it.
"I'll be damned," Barry muttered.
"That's something," I added. "Have you never measured this before?" Barry shook his head. "Thought about doing this for a while, but since we were told, well, I was told, there was no radioactivity, I assumed..." There he sighed, and then stopped speaking. I didn't take the bait and talk about the dangers of assumption. Instead, I took what I saw as the next logical step in my thinking. "So, those particles are being accelerated somehow, and it can't be linear." I held out my hands like a fisherman indicating the size of the one that got away, my palms spanning nothing greater than the width of my shoulders. Way too small to get them up to any kind of speed over that straight-line distance.
"They have to be moving around the reactor," Barry said, agreeing with my assessment.
"It's like a mini-cyclotron," I offered. Ernest O. Lawrence in 1932 created the first cyclotron, a type of particle accelerator in which charged particles accelerate outward from the center along a spiral path. The particles are held to a spiral trajectory by a static magnetic field and accelerated by a rapidly varying radio frequency electric field. Maybe we can detect those frequencies being produced by the electric field. Barry frowned and shrugged. "I don't know if that would tell us anything."
"It might."
I wasn't sure what that might tell us, but I was excited about the possibility that we might be headed down the right path at least. I didn't want to lose the momentum from having at least determined that a nuclear reaction of some kind, one that maybe didn't fit into what our current understanding of particle physics might allow for, was essential to how the spacecraft's propulsion system functioned. Even if our understanding was rudimentary, at least we had taken a first step forward. That didn't mean that a lot of other questions didn't remain unanswered. I was used to the idea that answers, even tentative ones, led to more questions. If the reactor's core, the structure that contained the site of the circling, spiraling particles, was central to how the whole system functioned and functioned so efficiently, it made sense to us to try to determine how it enabled this nuclear reaction to take place. Barry and I spent the first few weeks of our partnership stuck on the idea of how this incredibly simple system could do the job. It frustrated the hell out of us that the device seemed to so effortlessly overcome the kinds of issues that would have plagued any kind of propulsion system we used on Earth. Equipment placement and power loss over distance, for example, and how it was that the signal being sent from the reactor to the emitter and amplifier traveled only to those components and didn't disperse more widely. Our minds were boggled, and the only thing we could think to do that would be productive was to take a few steps back and ask a more fundamental question about the source of the energy, the fuel disk, and the other parts as well. What material or materials was or were these things made of? Here's where the idea of efficiency also played a role in guiding how I approached the problem of reverse engineering this system. The system under which we operated, how naval intelligence, or whatever agency truly guided these efforts, insisted upon compartmentalization and secrecy, got in the way of all of us doing our jobs easily and productively. Given that there was a metallurgy group functioning somewhere on the base where Barry and I had worked, you'd think it would be an easy matter to get a company directory, dial that line, these were pre-internet days, so no email, and request the answer to our question. Because all our efforts were so segregated and knowledge not shared, that was impossible for us to do. I can cite a half dozen or more examples of how this inefficient system worked against our efforts to be productive, but that one should suffice. We were in a classic catch-22 situation. Get this job done quickly, despite all the obstacles being placed in our way, to move with anything approaching the kind of speed desired. If I hadn't worked at a government facility before, and wasn't accustomed to this kind of quicksand-like environment, I would have either panicked or grown so frustrated I might have taken some action that was self-sabotaging in the long run. Barry and I had to work within the confines of what we were given, and we did. I couldn't help but think that on some days, when we both sat there independent of one another, silently pondering the problem that faced us, we were like shade tree mechanics staring at an inert engine, troubleshooting, hoping that somehow the device could speak to us to reveal what was ailing. In some ways, that comparison to amateur mechanics is apt. Given that this wasn't a terrestrially sourced propulsion system, we had limited knowledge about how it worked. When a car's engine failed to start, you could rely on some basic fundamentals. It would be silly to try to figure out what part or parts had failed that were causing the engine to not start. You could do that, of course, and start replacing parts until it finally did start, if it did at all, but that would be expensive and time-consuming. Instead, the better approach would be to think of the car's basic operating principles and the systems built to enable the three things needed for operation to function together: air, fuel, and spark. Those three elements had to be working together in proper proportion and timing in order for the engine to start. Looking at the problem of a non-starting engine or propulsion system, you had a series of checks you could make to determine why the engine wasn't functioning. Was it getting air? Was it receiving fuel? Was there a spark present to ignite the air-fuel mixture? At one of our early sessions together, when Barry and I were in that hands-in-pockets, staring-at-the-thing mode familiar to anyone who has been stranded on the roadside, I looked at him and said, "I wonder if there are any shade trees on Zeta Reticuli." Barry looked at me with a startled expression, and then shook his head like a dog trying to shed water from its coat. "What are you talking about?" "Nothing, really," I said, realizing that my alluding to amateur mechanics had eluded him. "Just that there has to be some kind of fundamentals to how this operates that we can focus in on." "What does that have to do with trees?" I went on to give him a quick version of the air-fuel-spark relationship of internal combustion engines. It wasn't exactly an Archimedes-like eureka moment, and no apples fell from any trees here on Earth or on Zeta Reticuli, but we both thought about our stagnant situation for a minute. "Seems to make sense, then, to focus on the basics. Go with what we know," Barry said after a few minutes. "We don't know how the reaction takes place, but we do know that something has to be fueling it. So, what? We're back to high school chemistry and talking about endothermic and exothermic reactions?" Barry sounded particularly glum. "That's not the point," I said, straining to keep my frustration with his attitude at a minimum. I know it seems like it's too much starting over, but if we begin at the beginning, maybe we'll see some things in a new light.
Barry smiled at my little pun regarding exothermic and the production of light.
The fuel's the thing, I agree.
Then let's figure out just exactly what kind of fuel we're dealing with.
Barry walked over to the reactor. Was it out of phase with the other part of the system it wasn't functioning?
He took the top off the reactor, removed the cap, and lifted out the tower.
He held the triangular-shaped, copper-colored fuel piece in his hand and squinted at it.
I still can't get over how small it is, I said,
glad also that it had been determined early on that it emitted no dangerous radiation. It was clear that it was part of a nuclear reaction, but it wouldn't be until years later that scientists here would be able to conceive and create devices that produced what would be called low-energy nuclear reactions. That meant that you could produce a nuclear reaction without nuclear and radioactive materials. We weren't there yet in our understanding of the capability to produce these kinds of reactions then.
Barry had taken the fuel disk and set it on a small piece of filter paper. With a very fine file, he scraped its surface, collecting a minute amount of the filings on the paper. He added them to a liquid solvent and prepared to inject them into a gas chromatograph, where it would be vaporized and analyzed. I joined him at the machine and watched as he inserted the material into the sample port using a micro syringe to get it through a rubber septum and into the vacuum chamber. Helium, nitrogen is also often used, began to flow as the carrier gas. I checked the pressure regulator to be sure it was within parameters. It was, and that gas joined the vaporized material we had injected in passing through a glass column packed with silica coated with a liquid. Since the material we placed in the solvent was insoluble, in other words, it didn't dissolve into the liquid but was suspended within it, the whole process took a matter of seconds. We were using a thermal conductivity device, TCD, and helium provided a shorter analysis time due to its higher flow rates and low molecular weight. The detection system in the device converted the property changes of the substances heated and vaporized into electrical impulses that a computer could analyze. Basically, it took an analog reading of the reactions taking place within the glass column and converted that reading to a digital one. The digital was less susceptible to interference and has a better signal-to-noise ratio. When we looked at the display the device provided, the chromatogram itself, literally a graph of the results, we noticed that there were no spikes, which would have indicated the presence of various elements. The X, horizontal axis, reflected the amount of time, while the Y axis measured the abundance or absorbance of the chemicals present. For example, if you put a drop of water in the device, you'd find a spike indicating the presence of hydrogen and oxygen. What we saw was nothing at all, except at the very far right of the graph, indicating that something was in there, but it wasn't composed of any other known component elements. The obvious conclusion was that the material we were working with was an element itself. It wasn't a combination of other chemical substances, but was one of the basic building blocks we call elements. Barry and I stood looking at one another, shocked to realize that the fuel wasn't a compound, that it wasn't composed of multiple elements, but was a single element itself.
"I didn't expect that," Barry said. "I was pretty certain it had to be some kind of alloy."
I'd thought that same thing. After all, we have a limited number of elements on Earth, and most everything else is composed of combinations or variations on those elements. Carbon is an element, but when those molecules get rearranged in a certain way, you end up with a diamond that bears almost no resemblance whatsoever to carbon. We figured this fuel had to be like that. Something relatively common that was combined with other materials that, working together in some kind of known process, fission, oxidation, or whatever, produced that enormous energy. I also knew that terrestrial spacecraft used liquid oxygen
and either liquid hydrogen or kerosene in their rockets as a propulsion system. Solid rocket fuel was made up of a combination of powdered aluminum and an oxidizer. Of course, we were dealing with an exotic fuel not of terrestrial origin, but the kinds of systems and processes we used on Earth were our only real frame of reference. We could try other kinds of spectrography, but I'm pretty sure, given what this reveals and what we know of its origins, that it isn't going to be made up of anything we'd typically find here, carbon, for example, or any of the metals. That's probably the case, but we can't rule anything out, Barry said, stating what I knew to be obvious. On the one hand, as a scientist, I wasn't supposed to jump to any conclusions, but this was a special case. And just because I made that statement hypothesizing the result, that didn't mean that I was not going to do the work needed to confirm what I suspected. The frustrating part of all of this chemical analysis was that we were both working outside our fields of expertise, physics. Eventually, we subjected the material to mass spectral interpretation using a process called electron ionization mass spectrometry. It produced the same result, that same spike off the scale, more or less confirming what we suspected about the fuel being an element. We also conducted something called a neutron activation analysis. Essentially, we bombarded the fuel element sample with neutrons. As a result of that bombarding, we produced a radioactive isotope. Since we know the radioactive emissions and radioactive decay paths for each element currently on the periodic table, the spectra of the emissions will reveal what elements make up the sample. In this case, there was only one element that made up the sample, but it wasn't one that we could identify. Every day that I was on site and Barry and I worked together, I could count on one thing. Dennis would show up and ask what we'd done that day, what progress we had made. We had to resist the temptation to oversell him on anything we'd done. We knew that they wanted us to get this job done, and we felt the enormous pressure of those expectations. But, as I've pointed out, we knew about the potential threat these materials posed. I also knew from my work in the scientific community, and Edward Teller's rise and fall within that circle was a clear example of this, if you hype something too strongly that is based on your speculation and highly reasoned and formulated opinions, you run the risk of being too optimistic. You had to produce results, verifiable and measurable results, that could withstand intense scrutiny and analysis. We also knew that Dennis was a layman, essentially. He didn't understand science to any great degree, so until we had something that we could demonstrate to him as an unequivocal explanation of at least some part of the process that we could demonstrate, we had to be cautious about what we told him. It was a delicate balancing act, trying to meet their expectations and ease their disappointment with our efforts. I was in a constant state of anxiety. Worrying about my job safety, my personal safety, and the progress of my security clearance all became like a second job I had undertaken. The problems we were faced with solving occupied me day and night. Though I wasn't working every day at S4 and wasn't physically on site there, my mind was definitely occupied by the work 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. I was vaguely aware of Tracy and our life together. I wasn't checked out of the relationship completely, but I was preoccupied. She seemed to be in relatively good spirits. She was enjoying the flying lessons she was taking. The photo business had proven to be something she could handle with minimal stress, and even though it meant us being apart, I was looking forward to being hired full-time. I wanted to be engaged in meaningful work, and Tracy and I were both adaptable, and we'd find a way to accommodate the changes that loomed on the horizon for us. Life is all about change and adaptation, after all. I trusted in both our abilities, and as frustrating as it was to work in that environment, the fact that I was working on such an exciting project with so many potential implications for me personally as well as for the world, from time to time pierced the protective cloud I'd inflated around me so that I could concentrate on the task at hand. I didn't spend any real time thinking about how my name might one day be associated with an incredible advance in our understanding of the nature of the universe, but I did wonder what kind of bonus might await those of us working on the forefront of an exciting scientific endeavor and what it might mean for our future. Chapter 5. In February, if the end of the previous year's rains are plentiful enough, the Nevada desert blooms with wildflowers. Various types of nightshades, geraniums and roses, miner's lettuce and others put on a brief show. In 1989, when I made my way out to Groom Lake and Area 51, I couldn't tell you whether or not a floral bloom or bust was taking place out there. From my seat aboard the aircraft, or in the bus that took us to the S-4 site, I had on figurative blinders, thinking only of the task at hand. My world was reduced to the colorless and sterile environment of the lab and its facilities. Funny that the word facilities is related to the word facile, which has as one of its definitions, easily achieved, effortless. Another of its meanings is appearing neat and comprehensive only by ignoring the true complexities of an issue, superficial. There was little about the job that was easy and effortless, and we seemed to be expected to ignore the complexities of the bigger picture question of how the craft operated. We were to focus solely on the one piece of the puzzle we were assigned to, and even the environment in which we worked reflected that single-mindedness of purpose. I'd never worked someplace that was so devoid of signs of human life. I never saw a houseplant or flowers. I never saw a photo of a loved one, a favorite vacation spot, a beloved pet on anyone's desk. No one had inspirational posters hanging on the walls of their workspace. No cats dangling from a branch urging us to hang in there. Oddly, or maybe I should say ironically, there was a poster hanging in one of the rooms depicting a saucer-shaped UFO with the caption, "They're here." We were so segregated from others that even when we were in one another's presence, we were not allowed to speak. If, for example, we needed to borrow the salt from another table, we had to ask one of the security team's members to retrieve it for us. I would have thought that Barry and I would develop some kind of us-against-them mentality as fellow prisoners serving time together, but we didn't. I knew nothing of his personal life, and he knew nothing of mine. I don't know if those who lived on site during the week were more social, but given how oppressive the environment was where I worked, I highly doubted if there was a more lenient and relaxed and collegial atmosphere elsewhere in that part of the desert. In the world of animals and flora and fauna, some species manage to survive and even thrive in relative isolation. I didn't count myself among them. I was not then, nor am I now, a highly social animal needing to experience the gregarious pleasures of others to be happy. But given all that was going on in that world, I was greatly uncomfortable most of the time I was in it. My irregular work hours also meant that I was sleeping irregularly, and that contributed to my sense that I was living in a kind of fog. I've always appreciated an intellectual challenge, and have always been able to dig into a deep reserve of energy to power my brain. When I was on site, I was fine and functioning well mentally. At home, that wasn't exactly the case. I was managing, but preoccupied. So when Tracy expressed some concern she had about seeing men parked in a car just a few hundred feet down the block from our house, I was a little confused at first. "I don't know," I told her initially. "People do all kinds of things." "They don't look like they belong here," she said. "What does that mean?" My tone betrayed an annoyance greater than what I felt. I immediately picked up on it and apologized and rephrased the question. "What have you noticed that leads you to believe that?" "This is Las Vegas. You don't wear a dress shirt and have your suit coat hanging in the rear window. And it's two guys. Always two guys. They just sit there, and they don't even seem to talk to one another or even look around. It's like they're at a drive-in movie or something." Tracy shrugged her shoulders. I'm not paranoid, but something is up with those two.
It finally dawned on me. They're most likely watching us for the security clearance.
Oh, Tracy said flatly. At the time, I didn't remark on how muted her response was, how a half dozen states of mind or emotion could have circled around that tiny mass of sounds.
It's all part of it, I said, needlessly, as it turned out, since Tracy had already left the room. I went into the kitchen and let the water run for a long time before filling a glass. When I put it to my lips, I realized that I had turned the handle to the right and not to the left. I drank the too warm water anyway, as if punishing myself for some indiscretion I wasn't even aware that I had committed. One night when I was on call, Dennis came into the lab. Barry and I had been working on an experiment to test how the location of the parts of the propulsion device affected its operation. We moved the emitter a few degrees from center, closer or farther to it. This, along with seeing how focused we get the gravity field to be, had been taking up much of our time.
"Gentlemen," Dennis said, "I'd like to speak to you both."
Barry and I eyed one another warily.
"It's about the fuel."
We each sat on a stool, and Dennis produced from his pocket one of the fuel pieces. It seemed to be an exact duplicate of the one we had been using. Dennis went on to explain that manufacturing an additional fuel element was necessary. He wanted our assistance with the process. I knew better than to ask, but I was immediately wondering, why the two of us? Yes, the fuel element was an important component of the propulsion system, but we didn't have a clear sense of how it was made or what it was made of. Dennis mentioned that the metallurgy group had made some advances, and there was some certainty, I was used to Dennis and his vague references and passive voice constructions that never clearly identified who did what or who directed or requested what, of its component materials. He didn't tell us exactly what those components were, only that the fuel pieces needed to be machined.
"That's the kind of stuff that the guys at Los Alamos do a lot of the time," I said, as much to myself as to Dennis.
"They do?"
"I knew a number of guys in the machine shop, well, one of the machine shops, and they were helpful. I know that from conversations I had with them that they were working on a lot of cutting-edge materials, high-precision materials, incredibly small tolerances, weapon systems, I assumed, highly classified work."
Dennis nodded. He produced another of the fuel triangles. He set it on top of the first one. Each was about the size of a half dollar and no more than a quarter inch thick. I'd handled one before, obviously, but seeing the two of them stacked like that made me understand something I hadn't before. Truth be told, I didn't give that much thought to how they were made, but at that moment I got a better sense of how they were likely to have been machined. They weren't stamped or cut out of a single flat sheet of their material. Instead, it seemed to me that a larger block of it would have to be shaped into a cone. From that cone, whatever cutting tool was needed could be guided to cut through that cone at various angles to produce the triangular-shaped pieces. For a few minutes, Dennis, Barry, and I discussed how we thought the objective might be met. I offered my cone-cutting theory, and Barry asserted that he was in complete agreement that my suggestion was the likeliest scenario.
"Los Alamos can do this," Dennis said while nodding.
He pushed himself away from the lab's countertop and walked out of the room. He came back in a few minutes with what appeared to be a cylindrical ingot of the material. I had no idea where he got it from, whether it was a part of one of the crafts or came from somewhere else, but he hefted it in his hand, according it no more regard than a deli counter clerk handling a bologna sausage.
"This will go on ahead of you," he said, nodding in my direction.
"We'll get the schematics drawn up, and then you'll be off to Los Alamos. As far as they're concerned, this material is known as LA-1000. As far as they're concerned, and as you're concerned while with them, this is a new alloy used for armoring."
"Understood," I said, wondering how soon I would be going and if this little field trip was a good sign or a bad sign for my still pending clearance. Could the whole thing be a setup to test me? Ultimately, I decided it didn't matter. I was told to go to Los Alamos, and that was what I was going to do. The next time I got the call from EG&G, I was told to report to McCarran, but that I'd be taking a commercial flight out of Las Vegas to Albuquerque. From there, I transferred to a different regional flight to the Los Alamos airport. I was only going to spend a few hours on site, delivering the instructions for the manufacture of the fuel disc and armor. The ingot was sent via courier to Los Alamos, while Dennis met me at the airport and gave me a sealed 9x12-inch envelope that I assumed contained what I needed to deliver to the machinists at the New Mexico laboratory. Based on my experience working at LANL, I figured the ingot got sent out on what we referred to as a dash flight. They took off daily from Mercury, Nevada, near the old AEC base camp at the nuclear test flight. Back in my days in New Mexico, we often received materials from Area 51. Looking at the airport in the city where I'd spent so much time felt both familiar and surreal simultaneously. I wasn't able to tell Tracy where I was going, only that I'd be gone for longer than I usually was. I had no idea how many hours that would be, but I told her not to worry. "I don't worry," she had told me. "I just don't understand, and I don't like that." I had no way to reply, and just as I had landed in Los Alamos with no sense of how I was going to get to the location on the site's thousands and thousands of acres, I had no way to reassure or make Tracy understand that if I could tell her what I was doing, I would. Trouble was, more often than not, I really didn't understand what I was doing. In my mind, that meant I wasn't withholding anything from her. I was the one from whom things were being withheld. I was being the good soldier, and had to trust that Dennis and those in charge had my best interests at heart. I knew that was never really going to be the case. I was simply a moving part in a large and complicated machine, easily replaceable in some ways, of high value in others. The answer to my wondering about how I was to proceed was answered by someone asking me a question. "Are you Bob?" I turned to face a young blonde man in his mid-20s, a wedge of hair angled across his forehead and over one bespectacled eye, like a curtain across a picture window. I nodded, and the young man said cheerily, "Let's go." A few minutes later, we were in a white passenger van passing through a security checkpoint on the property of the LANL. I had never worked in that area before, and even the entrance was unfamiliar to me. My driver hadn't engaged me in any kind of conversation, and I wasn't feeling particularly chatty myself. I was very tired, and may even have dozed off for a second or two on the drive over, just as I had, though for much longer, while on the flight in. The van stopped in front of an administrative building, what looked like a typical office building. There, I gave my name to a man behind a reception desk and picked up my visitor badge. He made a quick call, and then a woman came into the waiting area, and without introducing herself, asked me for the envelope I'd been carrying. She left immediately, and I stood there wondering what I was supposed to do next. After a few moments of me standing there, the woman returned, without the folder, and said that I was to follow her. I went into an office and was introduced to the man who supervised this particular machine shop. We went over the specs and how we wanted the cylinder to be sliced into discs, then stack those discs, fuse them, then machine that into a cone, and then into the triangle-shaped bits we'd been using to help power the reactor. None of what I asked registered on the face of the man I was speaking with. He spent most of his time looking at the specification sheet and the schematic. In some ways, I envied him. He looked at the task as a kind of simple mechanical engineering fabrication problem. I knew that people like him worked with plutonium as part of the nuclear weapons making, so given that none of what I was describing to him involved fissile materials, at least as far as I knew, this was, pardon the pun, a relatively run-of-the-mill operation for him and his people. "Of course, we also need all of the material back," I said. there'd be a minute amount of residue or leavings produced in fabricating the fuel triangles, but we still needed even the tiniest fragment to be returned to us. Any idea what kind of phase changes or thermal expansion we might be dealing with? He asked, ignoring my statement entirely. I don't believe there will be an issue, but with the kind of tolerances we're talking about, I shrugged, but didn't go on. I was tempted to try to ingratiate myself to him and his people by letting him know that I understood about the work they did, how creating an alloy with plutonium and gallium and other things was part of what they were responsible for, materials that presumably were far more volatile than what had been shipped to them. Instead, I let him, the expert, work out for himself how they'd get the job done. I wasn't worried about that at all, and shortly before I left the office, the supervisor sat staring off into the upper corner of the room for a few seconds, and then a satisfied smile spread across her face. I think I've got a better idea of how to get this done. He reached into a drawer and pulled out a small notebook and began scratching out a few notes. I didn't want to disturb him, so I simply said, "I'll let myself out." Receiving no response, I walked out of the office and back into the waiting room. In what seemed like no time, I was driving back home from McCarran. I arrived home in the late evening, just around dinner time, and noticed that the car that Tracy had talked about wasn't there. Tracy wasn't home either. She left no note, so I put a frozen meal in the microwave and sat there eating the overly crisp outside of a macaroni and cheese dish and its still only partly thawed innards. Fatigue overtook me while I sat in an easy chair, and before I knew it, sunlight on my face had awakened me. Stiff and sore from my cramped sleep, I stood in the hot shower, hoping to ease the tension from my muscles. As soon as I had toweled myself off, the phone rang, and less than 20 minutes later I was out the door and heading back to McCarran and on my way to S4. A cup of coffee and a fast-food egg sandwich of some kind jousting in my belly as I followed Dennis into an unmarked office. "Take a seat," Dennis said. Tired, and tired of Dennis's no-nonsense approach to things, I sat down in the chair and made no effort to engage him in any conversation at all. "A new directive has been issued." Dennis rummaged through a desk drawer and withdrew some papers. I thought that he'd tell me about the new emphasis we were to take in our research. Instead, he pulled out a small caliber revolver, what looked to be a .22 cal Smith & Wesson, and placed it on the desk. "You're to carry this at all times when you're off-site." Whether it was exhaustion and discomfort, or I'd bought into too much of the Iron Curtain propaganda that had permeated life in the U.S. for a while, I immediately thought of the 4 Russian scientists who had once been seen regularly around the facility. They hadn't been seen for a few weeks, and even Barry, loath as he was to engage in anything even approximating office gossip, had commented on their absence. I also speculated about what had transpired, and was now putting 2 and 2 together and coming up with 22. I didn't respond to Dennis at first, but smiled ruefully to myself, thinking that 2 plus 2 equals .44, the caliber of the long-barreled Magnum I owned. I wasn't exactly a gun aficionado, but given how much I liked explosives, I enjoyed owning a weapon and appreciated what one could do for me. I also owned an Uzi submachine gun that I appreciated for its design. I didn't let Dennis know about the Uzi, but I told him that I didn't need or want the .22 he was about to issue to me. I admired both the weapons I owned, but also understood that, on a certain level, practicality, they were ridiculous to own. I had purchased a holster so that I could carry the .44 on my person, and that meant that I would have to wear a long coat to cover it. Not ideal in the heat of Las Vegas, and only a little more so when I lived in New Mexico. At the mention of the Smith & Wesson Magnum, Dennis slipped a bit for the first time in the 2 months I'd known him. One eyebrow raised a fraction of an inch, but then quickly settled. "Have I made your day?" I asked him, referencing Clint Eastwood's 44 Magnum-carrying character Harry Kane and the famous line from the film Dirty Harry.
Funny, Dennis said, showing no sign at all that he saw the humor in my remark.
At least I won't have to fill out these forms. That makes my day.
I'd expected him to put up more of a fight with me on this point, but was glad that he hadn't. I was familiar with my 44 and more comfortable with it. I wasn't comfortable with the idea that I needed to be comfortable with the weapon. I pushed as many of those thoughts outside my mind as I could.
We're done, Dennis said. I went back to the lab. Barry looked up at me, but didn't ask a thing about my meeting with Dennis.
There really is nothing unusual going on here, he said. He handed me a readout from the gas chromatograph. We'd decided to do an analysis of the copper-looking plates on the sides of the emitter. In appearance, they seemed to be the same material as the fuel triangles, but proved to be, based on this analysis, made of common elements.
Not exotic at all, I said, handing the sheet back to Barry.
Not the most typical of alloys, but...
I let the sentence trail off. Barry nodded distractedly.
Have you given any thought to what I suggested about building that measurement device? With the right instrument, we'd be able to produce more verifiable results.
It makes sense. Time is the one concern I have.
I agree, but with the kind of seat-of-the-pants tests we've been doing, we don't have any way to quantify the effect of the reactor, I said, thinking of the various demonstrations we'd been doing in the last few sessions. They were variations on the golf ball demonstration that Barry had done for me. We could see the results of the gravity wave, but we hadn't done a very good job of measuring the effect on an object placed in its path.
I've got a pretty good idea of how to fabricate an instrument that will work. My first job out of college was with an electronics firm. I used to repair and refurbish pressure regulators. If they can measure minute pressure differentials, they should be able to measure the effects of the gravity wave. They'd also give us a sense of how the wave disperses.
We'd have to build something fairly large to do that. What diameter would you estimate?
60 inches?
We'll have to get quite a few of those sensors, and then we can get started. I'll talk to Dennis.
On the flight back to Las Vegas, I was thinking more about the conversation I had with Dennis than the one that Barry was going to have with him. I speculated about the presence of the men outside our house. I'd been fairly well convinced that they were part of the security firm who was investigating me so that I could receive the top-level clearance I needed. After hearing Dennis imply that I needed to be more concerned about my personal safety, I wondered if those guys had been assigned because of some imminent threat to Tracy or me. Worst-case scenario, what if those men hadn't been working for our side and instead were working against us? It seemed unlikely, but the whole what happened to the Russians and why had we been cooperating with our sworn enemy scenario was generating its own bit of paranoia. I wondered if there was some device that I could make to measure the influence of paranoia on me. Even without that device, I began to carry my 44 Magnum and the Uzi in my car. We got the approval to build the device, and over the course of the next few weeks, I worked at wiring the sensors in sequence. We had to use dozens and dozens of them. The work was tedious, but at least I could leave after each work session and see some progress. We also got some great news during that period of building the measurement instrument. The fuel triangles came back from LANL, and they worked just as the ones that we'd first been supplied with. Everyone was very pleased, and even Dennis showed some enthusiasm with a good work compliment. I hoped my involvement in the Los Alamos venture might offset a slight blunder that could have spoiled any chance I had of getting the job full-time. Before I began to carry my weapons with me, I decided that I'd better register them. The registration process was going to be easy, but I tripped up when I told a friend of mine that I could only spend a few minutes with him having lunch because I had an errand to do.
"What's that?" Gene asked, a perfectly normal conversational tactic.
"I have to register my guns," I told him. and then added, regretting the slip of the tongue as soon as it was out of my mouth, I need to use them for work. By this point in 1989, I had known Gene Huff for almost 5 years. He worked as a real estate appraiser, and taking photos was part and parcel of his job. We'd met because of my photo processing company, and since Gene worked very regularly and needed frequent photo service, we spoke on a number of occasions and eventually became friends. Actually, Gene dealt with Tracy originally when she was doing some of the drop-offs for me while I ran the equipment. She'd stop by his office, chat a bit, and they talked a few times about living in Los Alamos. Gene assumed that I worked in photo processing there, and it was only later when we became friends and we'd talked about a wide variety of things that he finally said to me, "You know, you speak so knowledgeably about so many things. You've got your rocket car and everything else. You sound like a scientist and not just Bob the photo guy." Well, I am a scientist. I've studied and have degrees in electronics and physics. Why didn't you say anything? What? Was I supposed to hand you your photos and say, "By the way, I'm a scientist"? Yeah, that's what I would have done. Well, I'm not like that, I told him. Eventually, Gene and I grew closer, and we'd talk about a lot of things. But what my new work was, and why I might need a gun, was not on the list of topics to be discussed. To his credit, Gene saw how I had blanched when I made the mistake of mentioning the gun and work, and he didn't press me for details. Still, that I had let my guard down that way bothered me a lot. I trusted Gene. After all, he trusted me enough to sit at my kitchen table with me while I mixed up a batch of nitroglycerin and went off into the desert with me to witness its explosive force. Gene shared an interest in explosives and pyrotechnics, and 2 years earlier, in 1987, we had initiated a gathering in the desert of fellow enthusiasts for what eventually became known as Desert Blast. Through that and other shared interests, I also met John, the second son of the founder of the aircraft manufacturing firm Bill Lear, he of the Lear Jet fame. John was an accomplished pilot himself, and later gained some notoriety due to his claims about extraterrestrial life. John and Gene were both very interesting men, with active and inquiring minds, and the kind of curiosity that I possessed as well. I met John through Gene. Gene had watched a local TV show that George Knapp, a journalist at the local ABC television affiliate, was doing called On the Record. John Lear was George's guest. He was an active believer in what was termed ufology. He believed in the existence of alien life, that extraterrestrial craft had come from other planets and solar systems. He appeared at panels on the subject, and he mentioned to me on several occasions that he believed that alien craft were being flown in the desert outside Las Vegas. Gene had some interest in the subject, as did a lot of people in the Las Vegas area, due to the frequent sightings and the light show out in the desert. He wasn't a proselytizer like John was, just, as I mentioned earlier, a really curious guy. John's views intrigued him, and he thought he'd call John up to talk more about the subject. That's just the kind of guy Gene was. When reached, John was a bit guarded at first. Well, a lot guarded probably characterizes it better. For whatever reason, Gene mentioned a couple of times that he worked as a real estate appraiser. The Lear family was wealthy and held several properties in the area. John lived in what I would eventually come to think of as a kind of compound, an enormous house and grounds. John seemed more interested in talking about having Gene come out to do an appraisal than he was in talking about UFOs. Gene thought it might be interesting to see the place where the pseudo-legendary, at this time, John Lear, lived. They made arrangements. In lieu of payment, John would share some copies of UFO videos and other material related to the subject. Gene called to ask me if I was interested in going. He said that I could pose as his assistant. Of course, I'd heard of John and his exploits as a pilot, so I agreed to go. He sounded like an interesting guy, and I was curious to see how the other half, the wealthier half, of Las Vegas lived. As part of the appraisal process, Gene would have to take quite a few photos, so I became his second shooter and gear toter. After a brief introduction, Gene and I went about our business. Gene always claimed that because I was just the assistant, John ignored me. Gene dropped names a few times, mentioning that I had once worked at LANL. The Los Alamos reference didn't sink in until that third mention. When John realized belatedly that I wasn't just a photo guy, but had worked as a scientist, we started to talk about his experiences and mine. The two of us hit it off. We had some similar interests in aviation, propulsion, pyrotechnics, and other wide-ranging topics that caught our imaginations and intellects. This made us, if not kindred spirits, then at least individuals who could carry on a stimulating conversation with one another. I also knew this about John. He had some interesting connections in the government and the military. He'd done some work with the Central Intelligence Agency, and he could tell a great story. I never once for a second believed what he told me and others about alien spacecraft. I tolerated that part of him, mostly because the rest of his life and accomplishments were on the record, and at heart, he was a kind and fascinating guy. I also eventually came to understand this about John. He had no bullshit detector. He'd never seen any of these objects himself, and several times expressed to me his disappointment that he hadn't, and in my estimation, he indiscriminately took in what other people had to say on this subject. In that sense, he was what I would call a true believer. As I looked at it, if someone said it, John thought it must be so. He gave the same credibility to something that someone at the CIA had told him as someone he met in the street for the first time. That's not to say that John was gullible or not a highly intelligent guy. He was an expert in the field of aviation, and his ability to recall information and to even reproduce on paper a diagram of the hydraulics that powered the landing gear of an L-1011 aircraft, which I once asked him to do, was nothing short of remarkable. I took his belief in UFOs and aliens with a grain of salt. A lot of other people shared his belief, but that didn't make them bad people or uninteresting company. I also knew that Gene was eager to learn as much as he could about what I was doing out at Area 51, but he didn't press me for details. The afternoon of my little slip-up with him, Dennis showed up at my house and told me that I needed to go with him and that I had to bring my weapons with me. We wound up at a Las Vegas Police Department substation at the corner of St. Louis and Atlantic. After we got inside the building and passed the desk clerk, and after Dennis had shown the man there his identification card, he instructed me to sit down in the waiting area. I didn't have to wait there for very long. Dennis and a uniformed officer came out a few minutes later. The officer pointed at me and shook his head. "This is the guy? Why would anybody, let alone the Russians, want to do anything to him?" I tried not to take the remark personally, but I knew I looked like what I was. A bespectacled scientist, and not a James Bond-esque spy or whatever else this cop had imagined. I also didn't like that he'd brought up the subject of the Russians again. Dennis didn't look very pleased that the guy had said something in public about the nature of our visit and the need for me to have those guns registered. That week, I wasn't called into work at all, and that troubled me a little. To offset that worry about how my security clearance was proceeding, two men from the Office of Federal Investigation showed up at the house. Tracy and I had a couple of people over, her sister Kristen and another couple we had become friendly with, Wayne and Robin. Wayne was a mechanic and serviced our vehicles. We became friendly due to my interest in vehicles generally, and he was intrigued by the jet car that I used to take all around doing demonstrations. At this point, Tracy had indicated that she was no longer interested in running the photo developing business. Wayne and his wife were looking for another business opportunity. They were over for the day discussing the possibility of acquiring our photo operation. Before finalizing any arrangements, I thought it best to get them acquainted with the machines and how they worked. Wayne was obviously mechanically inclined and used to working with various processes and systems, but this was unfamiliar territory for them both. They also weren't familiar with the notion that some representatives of a federal agency could come to the house unannounced and begin looking around. On the one hand, I was glad to know that I was still being considered, but the intrusiveness of it all didn't sit well with me. I was in a bind. If I reacted too strongly, then I'd amplify Tracy's irritation. One of the agents was named Mike Thigpen, and though he tried to be courteous and professional, something about him rubbed me the wrong way. Maybe it was because Wayne and wife Robin were there. Because they were, I had to reveal for the second time that I was doing work which required such high-level clearance. Prior to that, neither Wayne nor his wife were aware of what I was doing, presuming that I was operating the photo business. Tracy knew about the need for security clearance, so I told her about the search. She wasn't pleased about the idea of the two men going through drawers, closets, cabinets, and nearly turning the place inside out. Unlike in TV shows or films where they leave the place a mess, these guys were very respectful. Despite my assurances, Tracy was still shaken by the length the men went to. I told her that we'd done the right thing by allowing that search, though I was not really happy about it all. I kept from her my relief that their presence let me know that the investigation was ongoing. There had to be some reason why I wasn't called out to work at S4, but my being denied a security clearance wasn't the reason, at least not yet. Knowing that I was still in the running was far better than one of the other alternatives. I didn't want to press that point too much, nor voice to Tracy my concerns that this was an odd way to go about this business. The less said, the better. Let Tracy believe that this was standard operating procedure, and work to convince myself that this was true, and proceed with focusing on the job at hand. I can't say for certain why it was that a brief period of inactivity went on, but there were a couple of occasions where the reactor and the emitter weren't present in the lab. Other units working on other systems must have needed to use them. Of course, we were never informed of this, and it was mostly a surmise on my part and on Barry's part. But given what we eventually were allowed to do and to witness, that made the most sense.